Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. Thousands of exuberant demonstrators have been walking through streets Saturday in protest of President Robert Mugabe and asking him to step down from office. There are signs that say Mugabe must go, and not coup, but cool.
We are Zimbabweans. We're saying to our army, thank you very much for the peaceful intervention. And it's time for the masses of Zimbabwe to say Mugabe must go, and must go like yesterday. We can't wait to see his back. And today's solidarity consists of every Zimbabwean.
For us, it's about a new beginning. For us, it's about the end of a tyrant rule. And we are going to take our Zimbabwe back.
The military had stopped such demonstrations in the capital in the past, but now supporting the protest, directing demonstrators to the Zimbabwe grounds, where speeches will be made by a number of activists, politicians, and former freedom fighters. The Zimbabwe grounds is a symbolic location. It is where Zimbabweans welcome Mugabe back from exile in 1980 after the liberation war from white minority rule. Lebanese Prime Minister Saad El-Hiri said Saturday in Paris that he would return to Beirut in the coming days and announce his position on the crisis in his country after holding talks with the Lebanese President Michel Aoun. El-Hiri spoke with Lebanese President to tell him that he will take part in those upcoming festivities. He also made a phone call from Paris, where he arrived earlier Saturday, in meeting with France's young leader, Emmanuel Macron, who has said he is ready to help Hariri resolve the latest twist in the bizarre Lebanese political drama. He resigned in Saudi TV earlier this month. This is VOA News. Russia has vetoed again a UN Security Council resolution that would have extended an international probe into chemical weapons use in Syria. This is just a day after it rejected a similar resolution. It was the 11th time Russia vetoed the resolution. Russian UN ambassador said that the inquiry could only be extended if fundamental flaws in its work were fixed. And U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley told the council after the vote that the veto shows that Russia does not now and has never had any intention of making this time productive for this council and the international community.
Russia's veto, its second in 24 hours, shows us that Russia has no interest in finding common ground with the rest of this council to save the gym.
Japan had put forward a resolution that would have extended the investigation to identify who's behind chemical weapons attacks in Syria by 30 days. Thursday, the United States sponsored a similar resolution with a year-long extension that was also vetoed by Russia. Campaigners expect the Australian Parliament to legalize same-sex marriage in early December. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull promised to change the law to allow gay couples to marry after Australians voted overwhelmingly for a change in historic postal survey. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
This week, history was made in Australia. Almost 8 million people, or about 62% of those who took part in a postal survey, decided that same-sex couples should be allowed to marry. The result of the ballot isn't legally binding, but Australia's centre-right Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull is promising to act by Christmas to introduce a law that will allow all couples, regardless of gender or sexual preference, to pop the champagne and be wed.
Longtime Venezuelan opposition leader Antonio Ledezma arrived in Madrid Saturday, where he was greeted by his family. Ledezma, who had been under house arrest since 2015 for alleged coup plotting, said he escaped house arrest Friday and went to neighboring Colombia, passing dozens of police and army positions. Before leaving Colombia, he said he was planning a global pilgrimage to fight for political freedom for Venezuela. Ledezma, the former mayor of Caracas, said he had spoken by phone with the Colombian president, Juan Manuel Santos, who offered his support. Battered and beaten in Iraq and Syria, the Islamic State terror group is surging fighters into Afghanistan, rebuilding its presence and perhaps setting up a new base for attacks on both the West and Russia. Afghan officials tell Voice of America that Islamic State may now have as many as 3,000 foreign fighters in the country, many of them coming from Pakistan and Uzbekistan. More at VOAnews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
I want to thank you, the Commander General, Machuenga, in whatever.
He says, I'm happy with this situation. I want to thank the Commander General in whatever he has done for us in Zimbabwe.
Zimbabweans demand the resignation of longtime President Robert Mugabe.
The trip to Washington was very successful, considering the situation in Kenya. And he was able to meet various groups, interested groups, civil society groups in the U.S. and brief them on what is happening in Kenya.
Former Kenyan Prime Minister and leader of the main opposition, Raila Odinga, returns home following his trip to Washington, D.C.
Our new resolution set us back and said, go to Parliament and do this. Make sure that these things are known, denounce them, make them engage to change and dialogue and alert.
And the Cameroonian main opposition party, the Social Democratic Front, or SDF, boycotts parliament to demand the resolution of the Anglophone crisis. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Following the military takeover in Zimbabwe earlier this week, war veterans and other stakeholders called for a rally and a march Saturday to push out President Robert Mugabe. For VOA, Kudzai Vanavashe has this report from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
The light rains in Harare last night could almost be interpreted as the calm before the storm. This morning, hundreds of thousands of Zimbabweans took to the streets of Harare. More gathered at Zimbabwe grounds, located in one of Harare's oldest high-density suburbs, Highfields. The call for Mugabe's ouster has grown louder. Charles Moyo is celebrating. He says, we are overjoyed today because the nation has been liberated. It's Independence Day today. One elated participant, Love Moma Gaya, says he is grateful to the defense forces who took power last week. He also uttered a warning for Southern African Development Community, SADC.
I'm happy with this situation. I want to thank you, the Commander General, Machuenga, in whatever.
He has done for us in Zimbabwe. We were suffering for the past years with a false independence. As children of Zimbabwe, we are happy, we are happy, we are happy. SADC, leave us alone, let us do our own things and fix our nation. You failed to do that long back. The atmosphere is electric in the city, almost like the way the state media describes Zimbabwe's independence from the colonial rule in 1980. Some of the Zimbabweans here have traveled overnight to come and register their displeasure towards Mugabe. Gladys Chijoko says she expects better days. She says, we are hopeful we will live a great future in this country. I'm extremely happy. As children of Zimbabwe, we are extremely happy and we have great hope of a brighter future. For many, the situation presents a great beacon of hope. Mugabe has maintained a firm grip on power over the past 37 years, and a week ago, anyone could have been arrested for saying he must go. The economy has been in a sorry state for years, forcing most of the country's best educated young people to leave in search for a brighter future. Magaya says he foresees an economic boom and encourages his fellow countrymen abroad. He says, I'm seeing shops filled with affordable groceries, our industries reopening, all those in South Africa, come back, those in the UK, come back. Zimbabwe is now perfect. So far,
Negotiations for Mugabe to leave office are said to have not made much progress. All the provinces in his party, ZANU-PF, have failed a vote of no confidence to kick him out. This may eventually result in him being recalled by his party. Today's affair is not a political one. There is no political party regalia or slogans being chanted. There is only one main message, that Mugabe must go. The events unraveling point to the end of Mugabe's rule. Although nothing is certain, what is certain is that Zimbabwe will never be the same after today. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinamashe in Harare.
Meanwhile, regional ministers from the Southern African Development Community, or SADC, met in the Botswana capital, Gaborone, Thursday to discuss the situation in Zimbabwe. Ministers from Angola, Zambia, Tanzania, and South Africa met to come up with a measure to help resolve the situation in Zimbabwe. The meeting came after South African President Jacob Zuma, who is also the head of SADC, denounced any unconstitutional takeover of government in Zimbabwe. To learn more about the SADC meeting, I reached Dr. Stegomena Lawrence Tax, Executive Director of the Regional Bloc SADC.
Basically, yes, we understand that these are challenging times. Our member state is under challenges, and we being members of the African Union, but also SADC member states being members of SADC, we have instruments which guide us. One of them is the African Constitutive Act, but also we have SADC democratic principles. So that was the major emphasis that all the stakeholders in Zimbabwe, they should uphold these principles, but also they should uphold principles enshrined in their constitutions. Because everybody is a party to this. You have the government, you have the normal citizen, you have the civil society, you have the security establishment. So the major appeal from SADC was to uphold constitution provisions and the Constitutive Act and the democratic principles in whatever they are doing to resolve their differences and the challenges which they are encountering.
Dr. Tax, did the meeting also resolve that some emissaries be sent there to help with the process or to ensure that some of these principles that the country is party to are respected in Zimbabwe?
No, it's not the meeting decided. That was had already taken place. By the time we were having our meeting, already there were special envoys which were sent by the chairperson of SADC, His Excellency President Zuma. He had sent two ministers there. But by the time the meeting was taking place, that is when they were also meeting the stakeholders, the President Zuma and the others in Zimbabwe. They are back. They have presented their report to President Zuma. We wait to see what happens based on the report which they submitted.
So at the moment, what is SADC going to do? Just sit and wait and monitor events?
No, that was, again, we agreed that it's not just we are sitting and we are saying, okay, we have met and it ends there. We are monitoring the situation very closely. We remain seized with the situation in the Republic of Zimbabwe, which is our member state, but the report was submitted. The report was submitted to the chair. The chair has shared his the report with his counterpart. Then it was just yesterday. So I don't want to preempt the report because I have not seen the report myself.
So what are your expectations of what is ongoing at the moment, and what are your hopes of a peaceful resolution to the challenges the country faces at the moment?
My expectation is that I know that Zimbabwe as a whole and as all the stakeholders, they are committed to peace, but also to prosperity of their country. So my expectation is that in whatever they are doing, they know that the leaders who are part of what is going on now, they know that they have a responsibility to make sure that the constitutional provisions are upheld, but also to make sure that whatever is done for the interest of the people of Zimbabwe. And my expectation is that they are going to resolve their differences in a reasonable way and in an agreeable way, amicably. That's what I meant.
Let me ask you of SADC's message to the people of Zimbabwe in view of the current situation there.
Two messages. First is to call upon all stakeholders to make sure that they settle the current political challenges through peaceful means, but also to understand that there are rules and there is a law of land, and that there are rules, there are principles which they are committed to, and they should make sure that they follow those guiding principles.
Dr. Stegomena Lawrence-Tax is the Executive Director for the Southern African Development Community, or SADC. She spoke with me from Habaroni. Former Kenyan Prime Minister and leader of the main opposition National Super Alliance, or NASA, Raila Odinga, returned home Friday following his trip to the United States. Hundreds of his supporters were at the airport in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, to welcome him home. While in Washington, D.C., Odinga met with U.S. congressmen as well as civil society groups. The aim, officials from NASA say, was to discuss the tensed situation in Kenya following the repeated presidential election, which President Uhuru Kenyatta won. Odinga pulled out of the race, saying the poll would not be credible. To learn more about the opposition leader's trip, I reached Philip Etali, the NASA communications director.
The trip to Washington was very successful, considering the situation in Kenya. And he was able to meet various groups, interested groups, civil society groups in the U.S. and brief them on what is happening in Kenya and Africa in particular. He spoke about democracy and how African leaders have refused to embrace democracy and have refused to have the will of the people prevail. Whenever there's an election, no African leader is willing to hand over power peacefully, even when they are defeated. Such kind of things are really hampering democratic growth in this part of the world, and Kenya in particular, because we've had several elections where he has won as Raila Odinga, but his victory is deprived of him. You know, like in 2007, he won, and he was denied victory, same to 2013 and even 2017.
Philip, what impact do you think his trip will make in resolving the current situation in Kenya?
Basically, it's about the international community knowing the kind of illegalities and refusal by the regime to accept defeat. It has been defeated severally. But, you know, such kind of things, you know, refusing to accept defeat and trying to cling on to power, you know, the Gaddafi style of leadership, saying that we are in power and that you cannot do anything to us. Such kind of stuff, you know. Kenyans are tired because majority of Kenyans, if you look at the turnout on the 26th during the repeat presidential election, was so poor that a lot of Kenyans feel so disenfranchised. They feel so disenchanted. But if they're not resolved, then Kenyans will not be taking part in this election. And that's the message that Kenyans are sending out there. Because if you go even in the rural areas, Kenyans say they believe the election of Mr. Odinga was stolen and that they are not going to recognize the current regime.
Raila Odinga's opponents are saying that why would he run to his so-called masters to go and complain or seek their help to come and fight his political battle in Kenya? Why wouldn't he stand, remain in the country and resolve any concerns that he might have in the entire process? How do you react to that?
Mr. Odinga has tried to explore all means possible to have this compulse resolved. Nobody wants to listen to him. Nobody wants to take to sit down to dialogue and find a solution to the current political impulse. So if everybody has refused to listen, if the leadership, the Jubilee regime of President Uhuru Kenyatta and his deputy William Ruto are adamant and say that they will not sit down with anybody, and when the NASA coalition tried to present some demands to the electoral body to be solved before we go for the repeat election, Jubilee leadership was so adamant saying that they are not going to allow the IEBC to listen to anybody. They should conduct elections as per their script. That's why Mr. Odinga wants to seek the help of anybody who is willing to listen.
What's next for NASA? Because some Kenyans are saying that it appears that the economic boycott that was launched by NASA appeared to have not been effective in putting pressure on state institutions and, for that matter, the government.
They're just trying to put on a brave face. That economic boycott is really working, and they're hurting. In fact, the companies that are affected are crying foul. They're saying how they're trying to reach out to Mr. Dinga to try and talk to his supporters. Because if you go to strongholds, Mr. Dinga's strongholds, which are many in the country, of course, the products that were ordered to be boycotted by the Kenyans or NASA supporters, who are majority in the country, those companies are hurting. So that economic boycott cannot be wished away. Nobody can just say, oh, that was just a wishful talk. And, you know, this has led to the sacking of the CEO of Safaricom, Mr. Bob Colimo, because of his ineptness and accepting to be used by Jubilee to transmit wrong results other than those that were supposed to be transmitted by the system that was set up by the electoral body.
Philip Etale is the Director of Communications at the Kenyan Main Opposition Coalition, NASA. He spoke with me from Nairobi. The Cameroonian main opposition party, the Social Democratic Front, or SDF, announced a boycott of this week's parliamentary session to demand for the resolution of the crisis in the English-speaking parts of the country. The SDF lawmakers stayed away as the Senate and the National Assembly reopened on Tuesday for the last ordinary session of the 2017 legislative year. The opposition lawmakers said the move was aimed at protesting the government's use of violence in the English-speaking areas, but the government denies the allegation as false. To learn more about the rationale behind the opposition parliamentary boycott, I reached Joseph Banajem, leader of the opposition lawmakers in parliament.
Our new resolution sent us back and said, go to parliament and do this, make sure that these things are known, denounce them, make them engage to change and dialogue, and alert whoever, the international community, the ambassadors, on what is happening. And we have started doing it. We did it by not attending the opening session. Other sessions are coming. And we said in our statement that we reserve the right to boycott any other session, but we also reserve the right to attend any other session where we can address these issues.
There are concerns that I heard from some of your members that SDF see Parliament that it has been rendered irrelevant as far as the Anglophone crisis was concerned, as any mention of the problem in the chambers appears to have been suppressed. What can you tell me about this?
They could try to suppress it, but now we are down here for the session, and if we had to be suppressed in the chambers, we have made our voice heard out of chambers by not going in. The fact that we are not going in has made history. But I will call your attention, because many people seem not to understand what is happening and how things happen. Take, for instance, last year, one of our colleagues, Honorable Joseph Weber, who made a strong point against the exactions that were being committed on our children and in our society. Joe Weber made a stronger point, and his point was taken. He was not allowed to, but he forced it out in one way or the other. So if it is not allowed, we find a way, we always find a way of putting the thing across, because that is what people should do. That is what leaders should do. If you are blocked, find your way out and say what you have to say, do what you have to do. You cannot stay back because you are blocked. You have to find your way out.
What other means do you think the government could deploy to resolve this problem? Because I understand the government sent emissaries to collect views and opinions about the crisis and the best way to resolve them. The government has also said that it's willing to have frank discussions to resolve this. What is the problem here?
No, that is bad faith. The government is playing bad faith and bad politics, because who are the emissaries they sent out and who did they meet? Because this is a national crisis which concerns everybody. And those emissaries who were going out and the people whom they were supposed to meet were supposed to be the population. But they sent CCDM militants who went and saw CPDM militants dressed in their party regalia, and they were talking their own business. So it did not concern us. And at this level, I think going down to the root, that's not where the dialogue is. The dialogue is with the head of state. We are waiting for the head of state because that's the only person now who can open meaningful dialogue, because we, West Cameroonians, if you want to call it, or English-speaking Cameroonians and Cameroonians as a whole, whatever problem we have, however it's going to be solved, whether amicably or through conflict or whatever, the only solution at the tail end is dialogue. Because if you take whichever struggle, in what violent way it comes, the end product is dialogue. And we are promoting dialogue to say that the only meaningful dialogue that can come is from the head of state, who can initiate that dialogue and who stands the possibility of bringing us to where we can have meaningful talk that can relieve our people from the suffering which they are going through. Many people, Mr. Peter, cannot understand what some of us are living and witnessing.
Your party has also directed its representatives in both the National Assembly and the Senate to push for the creation of a parliamentary commission of inquiry to investigate these happenings in the English-speaking areas. How soon do you think this could be established, and do you think the government will support such a measure?
The government may not support such a measure, but amongst us, when you create such a commission, you X-ray some of the happenings by facts and demonstrations so that the world knows. You know that there is so much pressure from all over when information flows, when information circulates. So if government is not ready to accept or entertain our parliamentary commission of inquiry, at least the world will be aware of what is happening in Cameroon. So the essence of the commission may not be only that it barefoot and government access, but it's also to let information out so that we can lobby other stakeholders that can also join in the fight to force government to do the right thing.
Joseph Banajem is the parliamentary leader of the Cameroonian main opposition party, the Social Democratic Front. He spoke with me from the capital, Yaoundé.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, managing editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of your breakfast show, Daybreak Africa. As always, our newsroom is on top of the news of your interest. We provide you with up-to-the-minute news about Africa as well as world news. Tune in to our show right here on VOA Africa, your trusted source of news and information.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotin, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the strike by the Ugandan medical doctors in public hospitals and other health facilities has entered a second week, despite government saying it had deployed military doctors to fill the huge void at the main Mulago National Referral Hospital and its subsidiary branches. There was no sign of them by weekend as the medical workers' strike continued to bite. The health workers' industrial action follows that of public prosecutors who went on strike over a month ago. Barnabas Tinkasimiri is a Ugandan member of parliament. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him in the capital Kampala and began by asking him about the impact of the medical workers' strike.
The impact of the strike, particularly on the ordinary poor Ugandan, is devastating because many Ugandans are very poor, as you know. They cannot afford private treatment in the private clinics and hospitals, so they run to public hospitals for medication. We find at this particular time when the doctors are put down their tools, there is no relief at all. The president is only threatening to sack the doctors. We find that one some kind of madness because an industrial action by workers is illegal matter. I think government should just engage these doctors to return to work. For us, as the people's representatives, we are saying doctors take a lot of time to be trained. They do very difficult courses. Government should find value in them by paying them their due. Secondly, they should be able to provide things they are asking to be in hospitals where our voters get the treatment. And this is the reason our voters pay taxes, so that they can, government can pay well the doctors and also be able to provide at least some necessities in the hospitals, which the doctors are saying, no, if the doctor pay us well, we are not returning to the hospitals which have no protective gear, which have no medicine, we are not returning to them. And I think that is the genuine demand. And then the Uganda is supporting them.
The president has threatened the doctors and even promised to fire them and bring in doctors from the army and police. Are there enough doctors in the army and police to take care of government hospitals?
There are very, very few doctors in the army and the police. Secondly, the so-called doctors, these are people who have done industrial chemistry. My neighbor, he did industrial chemistry for Macquarie University. He did play in all of the military units as a doctor. Those are very good at the doctors is talking about to come and start treating our people. No way. It is unacceptable. He will threaten the doctors, but we are fully behind the doctors.
Even other government employees like public prosecutors have been on strike for a month now. Why is the president so hard on doctors and not prosecutors, for instance?
No, because he knows the critical role they play, and he thinks he can just hand them like cows to go back and work. But that is not going to work. These are highly educated people. He chose to ignore the prosecutors because he knows he has constituted himself into the judiciary. He has killed the judiciary completely. He has to solve the issues the judiciary would be handling. So they are useless even if it does not spare them. But here, neither does he know any medicine that he can go and treat any patient in the hospital, nor does he have the manpower, the required manpower, to go and treat these people. That's why he has chosen to threaten them and also think he can deploy the other men. The other men, they are not enough.
Where does this leave the health sector, which is already in shambles, given that there's no good faith negotiation on the part of the government?
No, of course, the health sector has been limping. The post-independent government of Obote and Amin tried to help in revamping the health sector. But when it came to his government, just they went into survival, trying to do small painting, did a lot of money, privatizing, the whole thing. It ended up killing the health sector. But I only have hope when there is a new government in place that will be put to strict accountability to choose to serve the people, not to serve themselves.
Barnabas Tinkasemire is a Ugandan member of parliament. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Kampala. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy.
Voilà! Salam alaikum! legendary beat.
Thank you.
When I'm in a club, I'm not looking for love. Don't come at me, try to show up. So if you can do this, show me what you got. Nunca cresça, baby, não. Cresço dança. I'm ready, if you're ready. Show me that you're sick with it. Take my body, dance with it. And we don't need to know each other. I'm ready, if you're ready. Show me that you're sick with it. Take my body, dance with it. And I don't need your phone number. Show me you want to step up, just me and you. Forget about the rest. We can do it slow, or we can do it fast. You can die.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Impuga, producers Odette Frazier and Tadi Abeje, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaite, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, although the snake does not fly, it has caught the bird whose home is in the sky. I'm your host, Peter Clotin, Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Each November, the world marks the International Day to End Impunity for Crimes Against Journalists. Around the world, journalists often work at great personal risk to shine a light on abuses and corruption, expose threats posed by transnational criminal organizations, and counter disinformation and propaganda. These efforts play an indispensable role in the healthy functioning of our own democracy and also underpin democratic values around the world, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert. Due to their profession, journalists are often under threat from those who wish to silence them. In too many parts of the world, crimes against journalists go unpunished. In Syria, both local and foreign journalists have regularly been attacked and killed while reporting on the conflict. In Venezuela, the government arbitrarily closes media outlets as punishment for reporting facts or maintaining an editorial line critical of the regime. Security forces and armed colectivos that harassed and physically attacked journalists during protests earlier this year remain unpunished. In Iraq, media workers report accounts of intimidation, death threats, and harassment. In Sudan, the government arrests, harasses, and intimidates journalists with impunity. In Uganda, security forces continue to intimidate journalists and media houses, and government officials have shut down radio stations for broadcasting voices in opposition to the government. In Nigeria and South Sudan, there is no evidence of accountability for police and their officials who have abused journalists. For the third year in a row, Somalia holds the world's worst record for unsolved murders of journalists. In Russia, the lack of progress toward any accountability for the killing of high-profile journalists persists. In Turkey, perpetrators of attacks against journalists or independent media institutions often receive minimal penalties. This impunity has been exacerbated by the use of the judicial system to target independent media. In Azerbaijan, 9 out of 10 physical attacks against journalists go unsolved. Together with others in the international community, the United States will continue working to eliminate impunity for crimes against journalists. The United States renews its dedication to promoting a free, professional, and independent press abroad, and to advocating for accountability for those who would undermine a free press with threats, intimidation, and violence.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.